STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hello, dear friends. Greg Kokel here. Stand to Reason is the show, and so glad to be with you today, and I'm glad you've joined me. I appreciate that. And I think you're going to be glad you did, because I'm going to have a conversation here that is going to fascinate you. And in fact, I have really been looking forward to this interview with my guest today. He's the director of the Biologic Institute. It's a kind of, I don't know, I guess you'd call it a sophisticated ID think tank of sorts. We'll find out more about that in a moment. He's the author of Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life Is Designed. His name is Douglas Axe. And Doug, what a treat to have you on the show today.
It's great to be on.
You know, I have been waiting to do this interview with you for, I don't know, over a decade, ever since our dinner together in Toronto with Jay Richards. Do you remember that conversation?
I do.
It was
that was a while back.
It was Outback Restaurant, in fact.
And, okay.
The reason it stands out for me so much, I mean, you were there and you had just gotten in from England, as I recall, and that whole episode that you talk about in your book, Jay Richards has kind of bringing you around, introducing you to folk or whatever at the EPS conference there in Toronto. And we ended up getting together for dinner. My wife was with me. I was there. I'm not sure who else was there. It wasn't a very big crowd. Melinda Penner was there. She's waving at me, let me know. That's what I thought. But
she was there.
Yeah, right. And
okay.
The reason that it stands out for me, Doug, is because I just had this feeling, and so did my wife, that we were, as you were telling your story, which we'll get into in a bit, and you were talking about the research you were doing and the unbelievable things that you had uncovered there, I felt like I was sitting there watching kind of history in the making, as it were, and it was really, really exciting for us. So we don't get together too often. I think we had some lunch together in Seattle a few years back, and I ran into you over at Biola, but it's a treat to be able to talk with you a little bit here. Where do you live nowadays, Doug?
Just east of Seattle, Kirkland, Washington.
Okay, so you're up there in the Pacific Northwest.
Yep.
So I'll have to remember next time I'm up there, we'll hang out a little
bit.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Congratulations on your new book.
Thank you.
And is this your first one?
It's my first full book. I've done contributions to books,
right.
But yeah, I call this my first book.
Right, right. Well, every time we see your face on a little documentary for ID, my wife and I get really excited. So why don't you kind of bring our audience up to date a little bit with your project by kind of starting back where we started a little bit when we talked so many years ago for the first time. And where your book really begins to kind of lay a foundation for your desire to make a difference in this particular field in a very particular way, and a little bit of naivete that you had as you kind of pursued the idea that science is really interested in truth, and truth is what matters, and then your whole episode in Cambridge, because I think
right.
That really lays a good foundation for people to understand a huge part of what's going on in this discussion. And it's not just the facts of science. So tell the story for us, Doug.
A little bit of my story, sort of the history that I talked about in the book?
Yeah, that's right. The Cambridge episode, and
sure.
I remember you telling me when you first started studying this stuff, you saw people were cheating, and it really bugged you a lot, and you really wanted to expose the cheating, and so you decided to immerse yourself in a field that would allow you to do good work and come up with really good, solid scientific evidence, expecting that maybe the scientific community would be properly responsive to good arguments. And
right.
So that kind of,
I call it, in the book, I call it the utopian view of science. So looking back on it now, it seems naive to me that I think I bought into this popular idea that science is not like other human endeavors in that it has a method that allows it to get to the truth, and everyone who does science is committed to that method, and therefore they're committed to the method because they're committed to the truth. And therefore, if someone does the careful work that shows a shocking thing to be true, no matter how shocking it is, people, scientists that is, will nod their heads and say, okay, he or she is right, we have to rewrite the books, close these departments, reorganize. It just doesn't happen that way.
Right.
And it seems odd and naive to me now, looking back, that I ever thought it would happen that way. And when I have conversations, and I can tell people sort of entertain this utopian view of science, I just remind them, scientists are human, as completely human as politicians and big business people and lawyers and all these other people that we've learned to be appropriately cautious of or
right.
skeptical of. It's the same deal with scientists. So I'm not at all surprised by how things unfolded as I look back on it.
But in
the moment, it was at times very disappointing and very difficult. The short version of it
Well, before you get into it, Doug,
go ahead.
I just, I'm looking at page 37 here. We're on this same point that we were just discussing. You cite Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is the new
right.
host for Cosmos, and he makes this statement that sounds so wonderful, but and this, I think, captures the point you were just making about this this utopian ethic for science. This adventure is made possible, he says, the adventure of science, by generations of searchers strictly adhering to a simple set of rules. Test ideas by experiment and observation, build on those ideas that pass the test, reject the ones that fail, follow the evidence wherever it leads, and question everything. And, well, that would be great if it actually worked that way, but that's what you're saying. When push comes to shove on certain types of issues, it doesn't quite work that way, does it?
It doesn't work at all that way. We know from our own experience that we become very attached to our own ideas, and it's not a bad thing, because I think we build commitment to our core philosophy of living, our worldview, as you might call it. It's not something that's up for grabs every day. I don't think you could live that way. So I'm not
right.
saying it's necessarily wrong. It's just human and flawed and fallible, and therefore the truth is not always welcome. That's
mm-hmm.
just the way we humans are.
Mm-hmm.
So the short version of it is I took a postdoc in order to prepare myself academically to test whether Darwin's theory of evolution could work at the level of single genes. And I spent many years preparing experiments and getting to the point where I thought I had the crucial experiment that would nail this thing
mm-hmm.
and put a number on the probability or improbability of a random search, a chance search, finding a new functional protein. And that work ended up being published in the Journal of Molecular Biology, put a number on it. But in the process, two years before that paper came out, I was removed from my position at the mm-hmm. Medical Research Council Center in Cambridge. Not because I did anything wrong. I certainly didn't do anything immoral or illegal, and I didn't do bad science. It's
right.
that there was a fear, a culture of fear there, understandably, where the director of the center didn't want his center to be stepping into a controversy
mm-hmm.
that he wasn't willing to back. And
mm-hmm.
so I lost my job. I had to find another place to finish this project. I did, and it ended up being published in this JMB article
mm-hmm.
in 2004.
Well,
but in the book, I use that as an opportunity to teach about a lesson, that in another experience, an experience of sitting down with a great Nobel laureate named Max Perutz
mm-hmm.
and hoping that he would see the clarity of a result that I had that actually went against some of his own ideas. But again, I thought, since he's about science, he should see the clarity of this result and he should be willing to embrace it and be enthusiastic about it, even though it went against ideas that he had put forward in the late 1960s, early 1970s. Well, he didn't embrace it. Surprise, surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I thought, wow, how could he not see how correct this is?
Mm-hmm.
I used those two things and a number of other sort of personal stories just to show readers that science is so thoroughly human, it can't be perfect. It's always going to have these struggles where right. it's political at times, it's personal at times. Nobody is absolutely devoted to the truth. That's one of the things that they favor, but they favor themselves, they favor their career progression, they favor right. popularity and all kinds of things. It's a complicated mix.
Right. So as I recall, when you were working there at your bench in Cambridge, working on this very sophisticated analysis of protein enzymes, that you were kind of, for a while there, flying under the radar a little bit about what you're actually internally kind of what you were about. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah, and I reveal that in the book, that I took a postdoctoral position, ended up getting funding, and I got funding actually from Discovery Institute at one point. Mm-hmm. So at that point I thought, well, if the head of the center Googles Discovery Institute, they're going to find out that, that Discovery Institute is funding work in intelligent design, and maybe this will cause a storm and I'll lose my position. He did Google it because he referred to the website once.
Right.
It might have been pre-Google, but anyway, he went to the went to the website, and it didn't bother him.
Right.
But it was only later when there was a big controversy having to do with schools teaching intelligent design, publicly funded schools in the UK were teaching intelligent design, and it became a big political controversy. Tony Blair debating it in the House of Commons.
Wow.
That was the context in 2002 when the doo-doo hit the fan, and I knew something was going to happen.
Well,
pretty quickly.
Yeah, you kind of got accidentally outed a little bit. Your cover was blown, as I understand it, and then when you got associated with the more publicly, invisibly with ID, and then ID gets associated with the school curriculum thing, well, then it's a political hot potato. And you talk in there a little bit about how, and I think this would be valuable for our listeners to see, then how the press kind of characterized your role in this. Do you want to say something about that?
Well, so there was an article that came out in Newsday, a New York newspaper, that was right around the day that I lost my job. This was in March of 2002. And I think it was Bryn Nelson was the name of the reporter, and he quoted Bill Dembski, and I'm not sure it was a fair quoting. He sort of quote-mined Bill Dembski to say that Axe is coming out with secret research that's going to blow this whole thing up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm paraphrasing here.
Yeah.
This is the big, you know, this is the big thing that's going to blow it up for Darwinism and prove intelligent design. None of that came from me. I was always very circumspect in my conversations with reporters, knowing that they would run and knowing that I could get in trouble
Well, also, your work wasn't done yet. And
correct.
You wanted to make sure you had the goods before you came
right.
public with it. Yeah, which I think is a measure of integrity there, just regarding your own work.
Yeah, I was very careful. When I'm in the middle of a project, the last thing I want is to talk to a reporter and say, I think it's going to show this. Of course, you don't say that. That's not even good scientifically. You
right.
want to wait until it did show it, and then you wait until it's published or on the way to being published, and then you can say what your results mean. But in this case, Bill Dembski was stirring things up enough, or the reporters were with Bill Dembski, that they were coming to me way before I was ready to
right.
talk about this and pressing me on things that I wasn't ready to be pressed on.
And so then you kind of surreptitiously received your pink slip, right?
Right.
We need the table for somebody else.
Say that again?
Like, we need your table for somebody else, kind
yes,
of thing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so the excuse was the space is under tight constraint. We've got
mm-hmm.
demands on space, and so we need you to leave. Well, I was the only one who had to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Space wasn't that tight. We'd gone through periods where space was tight before, and you can always rig something, have two people share a bench. So it was clearly a fabricated excuse, and I couldn't find Sir Alan First was the head of the center where I was working,
uh-huh.
and he delivered this email indirectly through his assistant, so I didn't even get an email from him, much less a face-to-face conversation.
Yeah.
And I couldn't I couldn't find him to go have a conversation about it.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, I'm kind to him because I realized that I did put him in a difficult situation.
Right.
If I'd been in his position, I would recognize, okay, here's someone who's doing good science with good intent, but in this political climate, it's bringing controversy to my center, so I need to decide, do I back this person up and say, hey, this is good science, we're just going to let this continue, or do I sort of do I worry more about the reputation of my center and say, look, if you want to do controversial science, I prefer that you do it elsewhere, and
right.
if you want to stay here, you
well,
need to...
Well, this is a good story, though, Doug, because it just further underscores a theme that we've seen over and over and over again, one that you referred to at the beginning of the show, that the goal of science, the exalted idealistic goal of science, doesn't really get pursued consistently when there's some very, very controversial issues on the line, and then people, you know, dig their heels in, and it makes it very, very difficult for pioneers. And you talk about this, having the courage to stand up against, swimming against the stream and that the flow, as it were. And yet it's something that we need to do if we need to, if we're going to get to the truth of any matter that's important
Absolutely,
to us.
Yeah.
What I want to, I want to talk a little bit about the nature of the work that you're doing. We got a break coming up here in a moment, but maybe we can touch on this. Because this line is ringing in my head from our first conversation. It really had that whole evening had a great impact on me. My wife and I have talked about it many times since then. And this thing I mentioned earlier, that as you are working as in your earlier studies, you know, maybe your grad work or whatever, your doc work, you realized that people were cheating on this, and you wanted to get really, really good at your craft so you could demonstrate the cheat and show the truth. And you work in a very kind of rarefied area of molecular biology, dealing with proteins and particularly enzymes. And is your strategy, if I could sum it up for a sentence, and this is what I'd like you to expand on a little bit for listeners, is that you're looking to see if evolution can produce some small things that are necessary for the big things to happen, and if it can't produce the small things, then it can't produce the big things. Is that a fair way of kind of generally characterizing?
Yeah, sure, that's a very good way to put it.
Can you explain a little bit the details of that with regards to your own search? Research,
right? Yes. So the big things, I would say, when we say, was Darwin right or wrong, if he was right, then natural processes with no guiding intelligence were able to invent things like polar bears and dragonflies and human beings and oak trees from some very simple single-celled organism that was the ancestor of all living things, if Darwin was right. In order for that to happen, a whole lot of things that are less complex than dragonflies and polar bears had to happen. A lot of inventions that you can only see, you can't even see them in a microscope. You can only see them when you do electron microscopy or when you do even smaller things through crystallography. The cells that make these organisms possible, the tissues, and all the way down to the individual molecules. So single genes carry the instructions to make single molecules that are called proteins. These are chain-like molecules that, if they have the right sequence to them, sequence of amino acids joined together in a chain, they fold to form a tightly locked-in, precise three-dimensional structure.
Mm-hmm.
And these structures are crucial to what these things do. These are like the little tools and machines and chemical factories that make every cell in every living thing function.
Mm-hmm.
So down at the subcellular level, it's proteins and protein complexes that are doing almost all the wonderful work of life.
By the way, there's some wonderful videos by Illustra Media that capture this in graphic form. You can just see these characterizations of what happens on a molecular level, and you see these little machines, this nanotechnology all right. over the cell that are they're bustling here and there, building things everywhere, even in the most simple of cells. And that's the kind of thing you're talking about, the kind of molecular sophistication that's necessary for these machines to run.
Right. So I realized as I was scratching my head and thinking, is there some way I was an engineering student at the time, and I was thinking, you know, no one has done satisfactory work on evolution to show whether it can work or not. They just assume it can.
Uh-huh.
I want to go do that work, and I was thinking, where would you attack this? Because at the high level, you know, the very high level, how would apes become intelligent? How would apes give rise to human beings? But I have no idea how you would go about studying that.
Right.
But at the very low level, if you simply ask, how would one of these new proteins come about, I was pretty sure that would be the level where you could show that the whole thing doesn't work. And if it doesn't work at that level, then it's just a given. It can't get to the higher levels because you need these proteins to get all the way up.
So these proteins code for this nanotechnology, which nanotechnology is necessary for any other changes in the cell to take place that result way down the line in new life forms, is the idea, right?
Right, and we're learning more and more. Every time a new genome is sequenced for a new organism, we find that there are lots of genes, a substantial fraction of them, mm-hmm. 10%, 15% or more in many cases, are coding for proteins that can't be found in any other life form. So mm-hmm. The picture is one of living organisms sharing a common tool set of proteins, and there are hundreds of these that you can find through very widely different forms of life. But nevertheless, each individual species, each kind of life, has its own unique tools that are not present anywhere else, as mm-hmm. far as we can tell.
Mm-hmm.
So what that means is to get any new form of life, you are constantly needing these new proteins to do new functions that are not found elsewhere,
mm-hmm.
which means if you can't evolve those, then you can't evolve new forms of life.
Okay.
That's the way I would look at it.
All right. That's a good foundation. My guest, Doug Axe, his book is Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. I spent most of the day yesterday sitting in an airport, Doug, reading through it. It was absolutely fascinated the whole time. I just had it's a great read, and it's a fabulous expose of the critical issues that are at the very foundation of the Darwinian Project. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
Do you want to become a more equipped Christian ambassador? One of the best ways to do so is waiting for you now at str.org, and it's free. Just visit the homepage at str.org and click on Subscriptions at the top. From there, you can choose to receive newsletters, updates, and training resources delivered to your inbox for free. You can choose from Greg's mentoring letter, Ambassador Insights, Tactics, Solid Ground, STR e-news from Greg, as well as monthly newsletters from Brett and Alan, and more. They are all loaded with practical, concise, useful tools to help you be a better ambassador for Christ. And they're all free and easy to share with friends. So elevate your expertise as a Christian ambassador right now. Visit str.org, click on subscriptions, and take advantage of what's waiting for you there.
I have been working on one of the most important projects of my life for over a decade now, and it's finally come to press. It's called The Story of Reality, How the World Began, How It Ends, and Everything Important That Happens in Between. Now, The Story of Reality is a kind of a wide-angle view of the Christian story. It's a big-picture description of the meaning of the drama of human history. And it's meant to cover the basics of Christianity from a worldview perspective, in a voice that's really conversational, not religious. It's kind of a mere Christianity for a new generation, if that comparison doesn't seem too bold. Now, I tell the story using five words that capture the meaning of all of human history from its beginning to its end: God, man, Jesus, cross, and resurrection. The narrative, it's infused with what I call a kind of soft apologetics, that is, thoughtful reflections that are not argumentative, but rather are friendly appeals to common sense notions we're all aware of that point to the truthfulness of the Christian story. I think you'll find The Story of Reality to be, as Lee Strobel put it, a beautifully crafted description of the Christian worldview, written in an accessible, winsome, and well-reasoned manner. Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. My guest is Doug Axe, author of Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life Is Designed. He's also director of Biologic Institute. You know, for a couple of years after we talked, Doug, that very first time, I know you were here in the States. You had finished most of your basic research on the concern you were dealing with there at Cambridge, because you found another situation to complete that work after you lost your bench there at Cambridge. But I always wonder, well, where did you end up? And after a couple of years, I found out that you ended up at the Biologic Institute. What is the Biologic Institute? I called it a kind of a sophisticated ID think tank, but maybe that's not accurate.
No, it's beyond think, because we actually have a lab, and we're scientists doing science from an ID perspective. It goes back all the way, at least the idea of it goes back to early 1990s, when I had conversations with Steve Meyer, and we were recognizing that for intelligent design to take off in the sciences, there need to be places where people can do it without being beat up for doing it.
Right.
And Biologic Institute was formed out of that idea, founded in 2005, mm-hmm. So quite a long time after we had those initial conversations. And we have people who do science here locally, but we're also serving as kind of it's like an academic society for people who are in various fields who favor an intelligent design view of life and reality to affiliate with us and to do collaborative projects. And every now and again, we get together and have meetings and talk science.
Mm-hmm. Do you have your own journal?
Well, we started Biocomplexity, so that's freely available online. People can go to bio-complexity.org and see what the journal looks like. You can download PDF papers. That was born out of Biologic. That was me realizing, and a number of other people realizing, that to take the science forward, you have to have a way to publish. And if the whole, again, utopian view, if this were a perfect world, you could submit a paper that says anything if it backs it up, and it would get accepted in the establishment journals. But it's not a perfect world.
Right.
There are ideas that make people bristle, and if they make people bristle, they won't accept your paper, and you end up being blacklisted. And we had real situations where they wouldn't even review our work. We would send it in for review, and they would send it back saying some lame excuse. They didn't even send it out for peer review. So I realized we would be shut down if we cannot publish our work, and it needs to be peer-reviewed. It needs to be legitimately gone through a process to get published, and I thought, well, why not start a new journal? And that's what happened. We have 30 some stellar people with stellar credentials on the editorial board all over the world. So it's a full fledged, peer reviewed online research journal that is not dedicated. It's not defending ID. It doesn't have a position on that. It's open to the controversy. So, and in fact, in the outset, when we first founded this, we invited dozens of people who are against ID to be on the editorial board, and almost to a person, they said no. There, we have one or two ID skeptics who are on the editorial board. Nearly everyone else declined.
Well, you know, I love the attitude of the openness that you just expressed there of your community. In fact, the very first time I met Wesley Richards was at an event kind of like that. And Stephen Meyer was there and just the whole crowd, basically. And it was in Wisconsin near Milwaukee. And it was ID and its critics. And what the ID crowd did is they invited all of these people to come and kind of have a point-counterpoint discussion. It was not an open thing to the public. I kind of weaseled in. But it was fabulous to see the willingness of the ID community to engage the opposition, so to speak, and with the idea that let's have genuine peer review and a good attitude, and may the best idea win. And it sounds like you have the same sentiment here, and that's great. It did strike me, though, you get blacklisted from the other journals. They won't even review it, and then you get faulted for not having peer-reviewed material. You know, it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, it's not fair.
Yeah, yeah. So in any event, I really like, and I've thought many times about this thing that Bill Dembski said once, and he said, you know, look, at when you're playing in a game and all the refs are in favor of the other team and you're playing on their field and with their audience cheering, what do you do? And he said, here's what you do. You score.
Exactly.
That was great. That was great. That was encouraging. And that's what you're doing and you as have been doing. And I think your book Undeniable is an example of that. So let's go back to the content there. You're talking about kind of going after the big project of evolution by looking at the necessary building blocks and seeing if those little things can't evolve from one to another enzyme, change its function to make possible the kind of things up the chain, then you can't account for the rest of the chain either. So this is a very strategically significant approach you're making. Let's try to simplify the process a little if we can for our listeners. You use the word invention a couple of times already. Can you explain what you mean by invention and how that fits this whole thing and what the problems of finding genuine invention are by a naturalistic process?
Yes, I give sort of I have a particular thing in mind when I say invention, and I realize it's a more vague term than that. So I show readers exactly what I mean. It really ties back to a quote that's been quoted many times since the early 1900s, where someone said, natural selection may explain the survival of the fittest, but it mm-hmm. does not explain the arrival of the fittest. Mm-hmm. And that's been sort of a catchphrase to explain a gap in evolutionary theory where it's true that once good things exist, helpful things exist that help organisms to survive, they become selected and they predominate in populations, mm-hmm. but that doesn't explain how they came to exist in the first place.
Right.
And that's been called, that question has been called the question of innovation or the question of invention. And I decided I prefer the term invention, but it's they mean the same thing. They mean the first bringing together of things to form something complex that has a high-level function.
So in other words, natural selection cannot work unless it has something useful to select. Is that another way of putting
Correct.
The same point?
So yeah. It does not explain, therefore, how these useful things first came to be.
Okay, so the standard neo-Darwinian explanation is genetic mutation.
Right. Basically, that's saying, actually, the first thing that people say, if they're evolutionist, is natural selection. And then you point out, okay, there's a logical flaw there. You're telling me mm-hmm. that the thing that kicks in once something has been made explains how it got made. It doesn't explain
right.
how it got made. Then they back up and they say, well, that would be random mutation or natural variation.
Right.
And in the formulation of Darwin's theory, that's correct, that the actual process that first produces something has to be random mutation or natural variation within populations.
Mm-hmm.
Then the question is, now we've taken selection off the table and you're saying that random mutation can invent things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now we can go into the lab and say, can it really invent things? How rare are the things, how rare are the mutations that would be needed to cause something new to be produced?
Mm-hmm.
And is that so rare that it can't happen in a natural population.
Mm-hmm.
That's the essence of what we've been testing.
Right.
And you find, for enzyme inventions, clever little molecular devices that do chemistry or parts of molecular machines, the mutations that would be needed are far too many and far too rare for this to happen naturally.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we're just talking about one little piece of the project, enzymes.
Correct.
Okay, far too many and far too rare. Can you build on that a little bit. And you use an illustration. I think this is one of the hardest parts of your task in terms of translating your enterprise to the common person. But I think you do a good job talking about space and how, you know, finding an object in space, in a space, depends on how big the space is. Can you develop that a metaphor for us a little bit so we can conceptualize the problem that we're really dealing with to see how, even though some things may be statistically possible, they are actually physically impossible.
Yeah, so I would say not statistically, but mathematically.
Mathematically,
I can suggest something, an outcome that has a probability of occurring that's not mathematically equal to zero.
Yeah,
but it's so small that it might as well be mathematically equal to zero. There's no practical difference between a probability of 1 in 10^100 versus a probability of zero. They're both impossible in terms of practical outcome. And I use analogies, not analogies really. There are other examples that are more familiar than genes and proteins. So I use written text. And when you type a text message, if you're trying to convey some information, or if you tweet, you've got a 140-character limit. That's actually a good representation for the length of a protein change, about 140 amino acids. So consider a tweet where you need to convey some information to your followers. You have 140 characters, and if you have your cat or a chimpanzee compose your tweet, it's very unlikely that it would convey what you want to convey. Mm-hmm. And you can start to tease out how unlikely is it that an accidental process, hail hitting the keyboard or your cat dancing on it, would convey what you want to convey or would convey anything at all that's worth conveying. It turns out to be so fantastically improbable that it just can't happen. There aren't enough keyboards, there aren't enough cats, there isn't enough hail to make it happen.
You know, just to you made a distinction there that I don't want our listeners to miss, because you said communicating anything that you want to communicate or that somehow can be communicated. The point is that in this situation, there is no wanter. There is no one who wants to communicate. This is a completely unguided process that has no desired goal. And so there isn't somebody who wants to communicate a message. Even if somebody wanted to communicate a message, to communicate it in 120 characters when you have a lot of complication that needs to be communicated to build a complicated machine, for example, that's a huge limitation. But it's even worse, and I'm just underscoring this, what you said, it's even worse when you don't have somebody wanting anything.
Yes, and sometimes when I'm describing this, someone will come back and say, oh, wait a minute, it's not trying to do anything. You're arguing fallaciously about Darwinism. I urge people not to get too stuck on those words. It's hard to communicate these things without talking about intent, because that's the way we think of writing. But you could equally say, how likely is it for my cat dancing on my keyboard to produce something that's worth tweeting, that's worth communicating, that would have some desirable effect if it were to be communicated?
That's
so you can take away the desire from it, and you still have a problem that has to be solved.
Well, it seems
and those
to me
problems turn out not to be solvable by accidental causes.
Yeah, it seems to me the problems are getting worse, actually, when you take that away. And so it's not the cat dancing on the keyboard. It's the cat just running around wherever and maybe occasionally stepping on a keyboard, you know, and
there's
leaving a mark.
Nothing orchestrating it, and somehow something intelligible has to come out of it.
Yeah, and so the consequence of those different illustrations that you use, what's the payoff there in terms of conclusions about even this simple change from one protein to one enzyme to a novel enzyme that's capable of doing something new, which then provides novelty in the genome, which may be chosen by natural selection and produce something novel in the morphology of the creature. I mean, we got lots of steps of complication here, but we're just looking at the most basic step. So what did you discover in terms of the chances of invention at that level?
Well, there's two ways I could go about it. There's what, how did I discover it in the lab? And what I do for the reader of the book is I do give glimpses as to what the experimental research showed with proteins, but I do that only after I've walked them through the argument on more familiar terms, talking about digital images, talking about text, talking about all kinds of things that are more familiar. So in the familiar sense, the argument is simply, I couch it around something that I call functional coherence, which means if the cat dancing on the keyboard is to produce something that's worth texting or worth tweeting, it would only happen because the letters that are struck happen to be coherent. The letters form words, the words form phrases, the phrases form sentences. Okay, and so at each of those steps, it's extremely unlikely that you're going to have success by accident. If you just hit keyboard keys by accident, it's very unlikely that the first three are going to be coherent enough that they even could form a word. Most right. likely it will be gibberish right out the gate.
Right.
And that's true every subsequent three. So it's very unlikely that you have anything coherent, meaning it will all be gibberish and maybe you get a two-letter word.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't do anything. You need to get multiple letter words, longer words, and you need to get the words strung together
right.
correctly. That same idea turns out to be very general, and you can take it from written language to, I give an example with digital images, and then I also explain why the same thing is true of machines, is true of smartphones, is true of everything we invent, computer code, and it's true of the things of life.
Mm-hmm.
And for proteins, I show, first of all, I show that this functional coherence is just obviously there. If you show the interior of what's in a cell or what's in a complex system, and I use the photosynthetic apparatus of pond scum,
right.
basically, to
right.
show
it's great.
Readers that something that's that simple on the totem pole of life has these staggeringly complex things within it that show functional coherence.
Mm-hmm.
And that coherence goes all the way down to the individual molecules. These protein molecules
right.
have their own coherence, which is the fantastically arranged amino acids that allow them to fold into specific structures that perform functions.
Right, right. Well, we're going to talk, we're going to come back after break here, Doug, and we're going to talk about design intuition a little bit and Oracle Soup, and I think bring this to a level that where I think people can be confident, as you pointed out in the book, of making decisions about these that are sound and reliable, even if they're not PhDs in the discipline. My guest is Dr. Doug Axe. His book is called Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. It's published by Harper One. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment. Stay with us at Stand to Reason.
Do you have a friend, family member, or coworker who identifies as gay or lesbian? Or do you find yourself in conversations about the topic of homosexuality and want to make a productive contribution? Well, if you're either of these people, chances are you're wondering how to navigate those conversations and how to navigate those relationships in a healthy way, but without compromising your convictions. Well, I want to tell you about a new resource I've made called The Truth About Homosexuality, A Compassionate Response. And it's a DVD that includes the most comprehensive presentation of my teaching on this topic that I've ever presented. In this DVD resource, I'll present the truth about what scripture and science says about this topic of homosexuality, but also show you how to communicate it in a persuasive yet winsome and gracious manner. So I hope you'll consider this resource to help you elevate your understanding of this topic and make your conversations with friends and family who identify as gay or lesbian to become more Christ-like.
It's hard to keep in mind all the facts and arguments you need to address tough topics. That's why STR has developed a series of quick reference guides on same-sex marriage, abortion, and tactics to help refresh your memory and encourage dialogue. These guides give you concise answers, all on a single 8.5 by 11 inch laminated card. They're a quick and easy way to gain useful knowledge about some of the most important issues facing Christians today. With these tools at your side to guide your thoughts and aid your memory, you'll engage critics with full confidence. You'll be fully equipped to answer objections with grace and clarity. Get your quick reference guides today by visiting the STR store at store.str.org. or calling 800-2-REASON.
Final segment here on Stand to Reason's conversation, my conversation with Doug Axe and his new book, Undeniable. Doug, we've talked about a number of different things here, but really it strikes me that the core purpose of your book here, writing to a popular audience, is to restore their confidence in their own, as you call it, design intuition. And you use a great example, I think, to characterize that. It's the Oracle soup example. So why don't you explain to us a little bit what you mean by the notion of design intuition and how the Oracle soup illustration works.
Yeah, I quote, there's a UC Berkeley psychology professor named Allison Gopnik, whom I quote in a book as saying something like this: by elementary school age, children begin to invoke an ultimate godlike designer to explain the complexity of the world around them, even children brought up as atheists. Mm. So, and she is not at all in favor of this intuition, this notion that kids have when they look at a butterfly and say, God did that.
Right.
And she suggested in the article where she said that children's books should be teaching evolution to kids at a very early age so that we can get rid of this wrong intuition and get children to think more scientifically.
Yeah, well, not just children, but adults. You cite Francis Crick there, same thing.
It turns out that this thing, I call it the universal design intuition. It's widely acknowledged. The only disagreement is it correct or not correct? I say it's correct.
Right.
And people like Allison Gopnik say it's not correct. Everyone sees that it's there. Mm-hmm. Francis Crick said biologists must constantly keep in mind that the things that they're studying were not designed, but rather evolved. So why do we have to do so much work to suppress this idea that keeps popping up, and we're playing whack-a-mole, mm-hmm. trying to whack it down every time it comes up? I thought that would be a good thing to build the book around. Not that the intuition itself proves a point, because intuitions can be wrong, mm-hmm. but it's very interesting that everyone has this intuition. And so I start with that and play with it and see if I can refine it and say, what is actually behind this intuition? And if we look at it carefully, does it turn out that this thing is robust and it actually stands up to scrutiny and it actually has scientific content to it? Mm-hmm. And so what I hope to do is convince the reader that this particular intuition, this is not true of all intuitions, but this one is solid. And once you get that, you do not have to take any guff from a professor of biology at MIT. You can stand up to this and say, I don't understand what you just said, but this I do know. And can you come back to this intuition, to the basic principles that prove to be true in everyday life, and show me how they could be wrong?
Right.
When I give talks, I use an origami crane. So I show this piece of folded paper in the shape of a bird, and I say that any child who sees this, who's never seen origami before, would know that someone gave shape to this paper. Someone did this.
Right.
And the reason kids think that way is they're already, by age of 3 or so, thinking about what can I do? And if someone did that, I want to know how you do that. That's just naturally how we think.
Right.
What I do is I use... Did you want me to talk about Oracle?
Yeah,
Oracle
I think it's
well?
A great illustration, and especially a trait on these things that projects that require knowledge to accomplish, require someone with that knowledge to do them, something to that effect. But you start with the Oracle soup.
Yeah, so that here's an illustration, and I have the book is chock full of illustrations of various kinds of thought experiments. But here's one to try to get people to think, to realize there is something that instantaneously kicks in that allows us to know that certain things can't happen. What is it? And once we identify it, we can recognize that this thing kicks in when we look at life as well. And in the case of life, we're challenged in our intuition by the evolutionary biologist. So Oracle soup is what I say. Here's a culinary experiment that culinary scientists have found a special version of alphabet soup. It looks just like alphabet soup. It has the letters and numbers, pasta letters and numbers in it. But in this case, it has very special behavior. You take a large pot of this, you put a lid on it, you bring it to a boil, you turn off the heat and let it cool, and when you lift the lid, spelled out in PASTA letters and numbers are instructions for building a sophisticated device, something worthy of a patent. And then you can put the lid back on it. You know, obviously, you take a photograph, so you've got those instructions, put the lid back on, reboil, and you'll get different instructions, all of them sensible, all of them valuable. Well, I'm not even halfway into telling that story. As soon as you get to the point of instructions, when people go, this cannot be, this can't be real.
Right.
And what I do is I simply use it as a device for saying, okay, we all agree that can't be real. There can't actually be a soup that does this. Why? How is it that we got to that conclusion? And why are we all affirmed in that conclusion in the case of Oracle soup? But if we apply the same reasoning to primordial soup, we're told that we're wrong, that somehow in primordial soup it was possible for genetic instructions to take shape, which are more complex than anything I'm even referring to with Oracle soup.
Right.
In one case, we're told we're correct, our intuition is correct, in the other we're told it's not correct.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really a starting point for thinking about what's behind the intuition and why would it be so reliable in one way and considered to be unreliable in
right.
the other.
This is really helpful for me because you mentioned that sometimes our intuitions can be mistaken, and I understand that. But it seems to me for us to be justified in saying our intuition is mistaken, we'd have to have a really good reason to think they are. And
right.
In my view, nothing like that has been forthcoming from the Darwinistic community at all to deny our obvious intuitions about that. And in addition to that, as you pointed out, and this is really the bulk of your own professional work, is that there are really, really good reasons to believe that these things are not even possible at the simplest level, much less the more grand developmental level. And if you can't get a kickoff to the game, you're not going to get a game, that kind of thing.
Correct.
Tell us about the knowledge. I made a reference to a citation in the book about I thought it was a great insight about knowledge. If things take knowledge to produce, then someone with the knowledge is needed to produce that thing. Am I getting it right?
Yeah, well, so that's the wording that I use. I start off with this intuition, and then I say, what is this? Can we give words to what's actually happening here when we have this intuition? And the words I use are tasks that we would need knowledge to accomplish can be accomplished only by someone who has that knowledge.
Right.
And I claim I'm not guaranteeing that this is actually what we're doing. When the four-year-old has this intuition when they look at the origami crane, I'm not sure that I'm articulating it correctly, but this makes sense. So let's go with this
uh-huh.
and see if this turns out to be true.
Right.
And it does turn out to be true, uh-huh. that the things that we couldn't do unless we had the knowledge to do them are precisely things that cannot happen by accident. They only happen when someone who does have knowledge does them.
Mm-hmm. I
think that's our intuition, and it turns out to be absolutely true.
You have a great illustration there about a magician and the rabbit and the hat, and even though it appears to be an empty hat, if the magician reaches in and grabs a rabbit out, it's only because the rabbit has been put in there first in some way
right.
that we couldn't tell. And if he really does pull the rabbit out of the hat, then he's doing magic. What he's done is magic. So how does this, I think it's a great little tool. We just have about 3 minutes left, a little tool for people to assess what are claimed to be examples of proofs that evolution can do the work to create something new. And you use this illustration as a way of testing that. Can you give a quick explanation?
Yeah, basically, for someone to actually show that Darwinism can work. If Darwinism did work, it was effectively magic. So I'm saying if you're wanting to say that you've gone to the lab and shown that it can work, then you need to show us magic. And conversely, for a reader who's not a scientist, I'm saying here's a simple way for you to test the things that have been trotted out as though they do validate Darwinism. Do they look like magic? Or are they really, really much less surprising and much less awesome than a true demonstration of magic would be. It turns out they're all very mundane. So Dawkins, methinks it is like a weasel. Richard Dawkins and his uh-huh. computer go off, and Richard writes some code, and he comes back with a simple Shakespearean phrase on his computer. Now, on the face of it, is that magic? What went into the hat is Richard Dawkins and his computer. What came out of the hat was Richard Dawkins and his computer with
right.
a simple Shakespearean phrase on it.
Right, right.
That's not surprising at all.
Right, right. So another way of putting it is that all of these, in a sense, humanly manipulated events that are claims to demonstrate evolution has happened are projects that are designed to get a certain kind of result, which only demonstrates that design was necessary to make it happen in the first place.
Right, and these demonstrations are never very surprising. They're not jaw-dropping at all.
Right.
And they seem to be losing sight of the fact that what needs to be explained is surprising and jaw-dropping. For life to have happened by accident is very jaw-dropping. So show me a demonstration that comes close to that.
Yeah, that's
Nobody
the rabbit.
Does.
That's the rabbit coming out of the hat. Exactly.
Right.
Okay, I want to end just on this quick note. You mentioned the Royal London Society, whatever, I don't have the name
yeah.
right, as kind of weighing in very conclusively in favor of evolution. My understanding is just recently they've come out, and I don't have the information in front of me, but maybe you could bring us up to date. That there is some question now about their commitment to the Darwinian model. Is that correct?
Well, it's a society, so it's just an organization that has a bunch of member scientists. But I was at the meeting, the Royal Society meeting on New Trends in Evolutionary Biology in November 2016.
Uh-huh.
What's clear is there's a whole lot of people in the evolutionary community who don't think that Darwinism is any longer the main or the viable paradigm. They think that there are other paradigms that have effectively replaced it, and there's huge disagreement on that. But the problem is that the new ideas are every bit as materialistic
right.
and naturalistic as Darwinism.
Right, but still there are cracks in the Darwinist
Oh, yeah, there's
edifice.
A lot of disagreement there.
Yeah, even from those who are deeply committed to materialistic things. So that means that even with their materialism intact, these concerns are credible concerns about Darwinism, and
yeah.
As you point out, ought to raise questions about the materialistic project as well, which is kind of a foreign import to the whole scientific enterprise, and that's the thing they are not abandoning. Even Thomas Nagel, who you quote there extensively, who is an atheist who has written a book, Mind and Cosmos, against, you know, challenging the Darwinian model or the naturalistic model, but he still wants to find a model that doesn't include God.
Right. At least he's honest about it, so yeah. I give him credit for that.
Yeah, you do so well. Doug, what a joy talking with you here about your book. I hope it's not too long before we can sit down and just jabber without the restriction of a radio again. You've done an excellent job here at Undeniable, and I'm thrilled to be able to present it to our audience.
It's been great to be a part of this.
All right. All the best to you, Doug.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks so much. Douglas Axe. Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life Is Designed. There's enough here for all kinds of readers. If you're just a lay person, there's going to be a couple of chapters you're going to read through fairly quickly, and you're going to go for the stuff that's really geared for the lay person. If you're not a lay person, if you're somebody who really understands how all of this stuff works, you're going to get work from a master. An absolute master in his field, Douglas Axe. Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life Is Designed. All right, friends, that's it for the show. Thanks so much for spending this time with me. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now.
Listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.